The majority floor leader is reorganizing some bills so that if you're on the Senate Appropriations Committee, please look right now at your the bill schedule coming up. And if you have any bills that you're to present, then go to the majority floor leader, the Senate Appropriations, and the President, as well as the majority floor leader, will be meeting with, and I guess the minority floor leader you're invited to, will be meeting in my office after Committee of the Whole. We need to decide whether we're going to appoint a conference committee on the budget today. So point is, if you look at those bills that are the first 5, 6, 7, 8, and make sure that one of your bills is not on the list, and all he'll do is just move it to the end here. I think if you're on Senate Appropriations, you ought to understand what's going on. The staff loves this. It's called Ring Around the Rosie. So, do we have a schedule? First item of business is messages from the House.
February the 23rd, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message number 344, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 12, trespassing to collect data. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 49, noes 10, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the amendments. February 23rd, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 345, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate file number 33, precinct committee person election. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 51, noes 8, excused 1. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. You want these back? Okay. February the 23rd, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message number, concurrence passed. Mr. President, the House did concur on Senate amendments to the bills listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill 51, excise tax well site. Ayes 59, excused 1. And House Bill number 27, NRC agreement state authorization. Ayes 59, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February 23rd, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message, concurrence failed. Mr. President, House Bill number 42, unclaimed property merchant stored value cards. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 21, noes 38, excused 1. House Bill number 154, complementary hunting license persons with disabilities. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 10, noes 49, excused 1. And House Bill number 17, sexual assault protection orders. House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 27, noes 32, excused 1. The House requests the Senate appoint a Conference Committee Number 1 to meet with a like committee from the House to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills on first reading. House Bill 183, first reading of the bill.
House Bill 183, Insurance Coverage Early Refill of Prescription Eye Drops, sponsored by Representative Petroff. Passed the House on the third reading, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1.
House Bill 183 is assigned to Committee Number 10, Labor. We have reports from standing committees.
February the 23rd, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 5, engrossed mandatory judicial retirement, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass failed in accordance with Senate Rule 5-4. Ayes, Senator Hastert, no. Senators Burns, Perkins, Ross, Wassenberger, Senator Ross, Chairman. February the 23rd, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 126, engrossed, candidate filing requirements, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senator Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, Wassenberger, Senator Ross, Chairman. February the 23rd, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 11, engrossed, Distance Education Task Force, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, Wassenberger, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Next item is we have the Conference Committee on the Budget. Senator Ross. Oh, let me first go to the privilege of the floor to Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, privilege of the floor. Members of the body, if you would, Mr. President, help me welcome the fifth grade class from Medicine Bow and the fifth and sixth grade class, or the fifth grade class from Hannah, fifth and sixth from Medicine Bow, and their teachers, Mr. Fuller and Mrs. Booth. Members of the Senate.
Hey.
All right, Senator Ross. Are you prepared to provide the standing committee report on the budget?
Yes, I am, Mr. President.
If the reading clerk would please read in the House bill. You need a script?
Here you go. Here's got the script.
You got it.
Okay. Your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, reviewed House Bill 1. Pursuant to Joint Rule 4-1, little e, the following lists are provided. Dispensing with further reading, Senator Ross, Chairman.
In accordance with Joint Rule 14-1F, House Bill 1 is referred directly to third reading. And at this point, if the there's no vote on it, but if the Chairman Ross, if you would please, if you're prepared to do that, explain the differences and the process now as the bill goes directly to a conference committee. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President, and you're absolutely correct. You should have on your desk a list of the amendments, and then you should have a document that's on legal sides paper that has Ross, Senate District 4 on there, House Bill 1. It consists basically of three pages, the first page being the identical, amendments. Page 2 is the related amendments. They're not necessarily identical, but they're related. And page 3 is the non-identical amendments that were adopted by the House. We've divided it up, Mr. President, amongst the committee to explain each page separately. And we begin, and I would yield the floor to Senator Hastert to explain the identical amendments.
Okay, and for everybody's process, you're allowed and you should ask questions as we go along. So if you have questions on what, with respect to any item, let the JAC or the Senate Appropriations member speak, and then go ahead and ask questions after the floor has been yielded to you. Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. President. The first page deals with kind of like mirror amendments or amendments that were considered close enough to be mirror amendments. There was, on a couple of them, a little bit of language, but the end results were exactly the same. So they were put into this first page category of identical amendments. And the first one you'll see is for the House is H27, which was the Greer Amendment, which mirrored the Coe Amendment for the Municipal Solid Waste Cease and Transfer Loan Program. And unless people want the details, I'm seeing, and the identical ones, I mean, I've certainly figured you people knew, Mr. President, on what we did on the Senate side. So if you have questions, please stop. Mr. President, the next one is 2020.
Wait, Mr. Senator. What I think it's not so much that who the sponsors were, but each item that's an identical, you should refresh people's recollection as to the character of the amendment so they know which ones were identical.
Thank you, Mr. President. So for the first one, for the solid waste cease and transfer, removes the language that refers to the 2014. The SF 4043 describes the project list that will be obsolete with the passage of Senate File 25, the cease and transfer priority list. The second one, the House 2020, which is identical to the BBOT with the expanded foreign trade efforts, and we had appropriates 35,000 general fund to the governor's office for foreign trade expansion, and its in-country marketing presence in Taiwan specifically. The next one is the University of Wyoming. This one, both sides deleted footnote 15, which eliminates the study for a four-year degree program in Jackson. The next one is the Summers Cooper, which is the ECA. You see the adds the $6.6 million in continuing recapture accounts for the external cost adjustment to the school funding model, and which matched the amendments basically matched the governor's recommendation and adds updated funding model variables. And then the 661, which thousand, which adjusts appropriation based on the updated calculation, which ends up the end result is the same amendment that the Senate had. The next one is H2028 Northrop Coe, the school foundation program. Adds footnote 5, which specifies payment deadlines for the department to reimburse districts for Wyoming students attending out-of-state schools. And then 2041, the Conley Craft, which is the Women's Center, it adds the footnote 4 for a report on the mother and child program in the Women's Center. The next one is 2043, the Walters Bebout, contingent appropriations, and then that one goes into Section 345, reduces $5 million from UW unconventional oil and gas research appropriation, leaving the $15 million, and then creates a new line item for community college endowment matching funds. In Section 346, reduces the community college STEM appropriation by $5 million and creates a new line item for UW unconventional oil and gas. So those were the same amendments there. The next one is the Greer and Nicholas, H3022, the Wyoming Value Added Energy and Industrial Plan. And that's the as the language to expand the use of appropriated funds for demonstration projects and development beneficial use of the, and it's the carbon dioxide. And then you'll see the Harshman and Ross amendments, that whole series of amendments there. Strictly technical amendments right on down. The first one deletes obsolete references to the appropriation table, clarifies language in footnote 20B to indicate funds and this appropriation will be reduced dollar for dollar if House Bill 58 is enacted. And then, again, the next two are deleting obsolete references and then corrects the title of Northwest Community College. Adds reference language to Section 4, indicating 2014 session laws. And so these are just strictly technical. And then the final one is on the first page for the identical, was the Stubbs and Landed, the state facilities in Casper, and modifies the language in Section 347 to clarify the requirement for an appraisal of properties being considered for sale and removes the legislature from authorization process, leaving it to the state land board. So those were the identical amendments, the same work that the House and Senate did.
Okay, and any questions on the identical amendments? Now, folks, what happens is that every amendment has to be disposed of or dispensed with by the Joint Conference Committee. So the Conference Committee will be asked to delete one set of amendments and then accept the other, and you ordinarily do it in one blank. And the staff will, if the staff sees that they made a mistake, for example, one version or the other, they'll recommend that you take the House or the Senate version, whichever is the best, whichever one does not have the error. So when you see the report come back from the Joint Conference Committee, they'll have either deleted all the House amendments or the Senate amendments and leaving the others. With that explanation, Majority Floor Leader Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. I think there's a mistake, and just would ask my colleague from Sweetwater County, under Senate joint, the second reading amendment number 32, the Berger Bebout, in the cheat sheet it talks about marketing presence in Taiwan. That was the original one sponsored by the chairman of the Senate and Senate Appropriations Committee, and it was replaced with another one that does not have that language in there about Taiwan.
There is a deleted Ross amendment in there below that.
I just want to be sure, Mr. President, that the in-country marketing presence in Taiwan is a part that's not in the bill now. And there's other language. That's all I wanted to be sure that everybody understood that.
Okay. Senator Ross.
That is correct, Mr. President. The language that was modified from my amendment by the majority floor leader is identical language by Representative Berger in the House. And so that it was a little bit more comprehensive amendment with better language. My initial amendment simply just moved that $35,000 solely to the governor's office. That was modified by the Bebout amendment. The Berger amendment is identical to the Bebout amendment.
Any further discussions or questions on the identical amendments? Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just real quickly on the Walters Bebout amendment, I was just curious. It was my understanding that those funds were not necessarily endowment matching funds, but just matching funds for projects and or for endowment, and just would appreciate, not necessarily today, but if the Appropriations Committee could keep an eye on that and just make sure they let us know.
Be careful. If you're, when we're referring to these, you need to refer to the, so you were speaking to House 2020. You were actually looking at the Walters B-Bout, which was House 2021?
2043, Mr. President, the Walters B-Bout amendment. And just a little clarification, and I thought maybe that those matching funds came through not necessarily restricted to endowment, but to be used on projects.
There's multiple Walters B-Bout, Meeman, but you're talking about the 2043
That's correct.
Contingent appropriations discussion on that. Anybody from the Appropriations Committee? And those are the swaps. Senator Hastert.
I'm pending my amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. President.
Senator Burns.
I just got word from the back here that it is indeed for endowment matching funds.
So that's the swap that resulted in the endowment for the community colleges and then swap out. Any further to add? Okay. Any other questions on the identical amendments? So those are on page one. Now we move to page two. And the first next category are the non-identical but related amendments. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President, the first is the Hunt Amendment and the Driscoll Amendment. This relates to the money for court security improvements in Weston County. The House's amendments are a little different than ours, wherein we used 83,000 plus general fund. The Senate, the House, took the 83,000 from the Federal Mineral Royalty Program and 124 from the SLIB. So it's a little, it's just a little different. They use different monies rather than we utilize some general fund. The next amendments are the Larson, that's House 27, 21, and 42 Eklund. Essentially, that amendment with the case amendment, this is regarding the artwork related to Chief Washakie. We took the appropriation from the Capitol Square project. They did the same thing. The only thing that they did, they added a little additional language at the bottom there, which amends House Amendment 27 language and allows the Department of Information and Administration and Information to accept grants and gifts, transfers, bequests, and donations to be deposited to an account for the purchase of artwork. So they just gave up some more, some additional language there. In the next row, you see House Amendment 35, which is the Yagi Amendment, and the Kraft Amendment, which was to increase $200,000 for Home Services Program. The difference is that the Yagi Amendment used general funds, and we used existing appropriations from the Director's Office. So we'll have to clear that up. With regard to House Amendment 38 and House Third Reading Amendment Number 9 and 24, the only difference really here, this is on the Department of Health Facilities Task Force. They softened the language a little bit in the review, which is down at the bottom of that column. They added language defining the scope of review of the Wyoming Retirement Center. But otherwise, so it allows for some more explanation, exploration of additional options, but the language is basically a little softer than the language that we had in the Senate. The next column is the Summers, Harvey, and Ross amendments with regard to footnote 13. The difference here is that in we use language that came from the department and the providers. It included tobacco trust money and general fund. Their amendment only deals with general fund, so there's a little difference there. But basically, a similar amendment with regard to how we, with regard to the former amendment concerning footnote 13. The next one's a little bit more complicated, and I'll do my best to explain it, but that is the Harshman and Ross amendments regarding local government distributions. The differences here are, first of all, we have a distribution formula in the Senate that cities and towns under 1,000 get a direct distribution of $25,000. The other difference between the two is that the House has $10 million to cities, towns, and counties. The Senate has $6 million to cities, towns, and counties. The House utilized swapping of funds from the Gillette Madison and the University of Wyoming Engineering and High Bay. In the Senate, we use a swap of the $5.8 million AML funds from the Wildlife Natural Resource Trust Fund, and that were unspent AML dollars, and we used we swapped that money with the ITC, the Integrated Test Center, and so there's going to be some differences there in how we use the money. They used a swap with the High Bay and Engineering. We used a swap of those monies with the ITC. And that's the differences between there. Of course, we'll have to work out the differences because there's a $10 million in the House and we have $6 million here in the Senate. The Throne Amendment and the Rothfuss Amendment, which is House Third Reading Amendment 33 and Senate Second Reading Amendment 15. The difference there is that in the House they had some additional language concerning dual and concurrent enrollment. And we specifically, I think, just had language concerning the IB programs. And then the last column or row is the Berger and Landon amendments. This is on the studying of the community colleges. There's some language difference there. You recall that in the Senate, I moved to divide the Landon Amendment, and we took out paragraph B of the Landon Amendment, so it's a little bit more general language. The Berger Amendment, I think, has the same or similar language that was originally in it from as Senator Landon had brought it to the Senate. So those are the related amendments. I stand for any questions in that regard.
So we're now on the related but non-identicals. Typically, remember, the first conference committee is required to negotiate between the differences of both houses. If you're at the conference committee, generally the motion is to delete all the amendments and further amend with whatever the compromise proposed at the time. So it's a delete and further amend a motion. Senator Scott, questions?
Mr. President, not so much a question, but
On the amendment that was House 235A, Senate 3004, on the aging division of the $200,000 for the home services program. Now, we're identical as to the expenditure of the money, but the really a major difference in where you get it, the House increased the total spending by $200,000. The Senate took it out of the administration, and I would hope that we would recognize that's a major difference. Obviously, you can compromise on the amount of the money that's new and the amount of the money that's taken out of the existing appropriation. But just want to emphasize that there is a big difference there in what that did.
That's almost true for the entire column. If you look at all the columns, for those people just trying to adjust into this table, your appropriations are in about the middle, and you've got a line or a column for general funds, federal funds, and OF, other funds. And those, the swaps really don't reflect in those. What you see are the adjustment of funds from either the general fund, federal funds, or other funds. So in this example, there's $200,000 to the general fund. That means it's a deduct, and it's a blank for the House, or that shows you there's a $200,000 difference. Senator Burns.
Mr. President, just for further edification on that particular topic, the fund that we did take that $200,000 of the director's appropriation is about, according to testimony, is about $20 million. So we're talking about 1% of the director's appropriation.
Further questions on the related but non-identical page, which is page 2? If not, we'll move to page 3. Which are the non-identicals, non-related. Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, we'll go to the non-identical and yield the floor to the Vice President.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. President. What you're looking at here and the identicals, these are the ones, obviously, as a prefatory remark, Mr. President, the ones we have here are ones that in the House that we didn't have anything, we didn't have a similar amendment over here. Keep in mind that we have a number of amendments in our side that are over there. They don't appear on here. The ones that we did that don't show up over there don't show up on this list. We're assuming that you remember the ones that we did, which may be a faulty assumption, but nevertheless, we're looking at this from what did the House do that we didn't do over here. So with that, going on to the explanation, the first one was was the Larson Amendment, second read amendment number 3. And what you did there was the nursing home rebasing. We had done 75%. This amount would put it up to a full 100%. The second one, which is second read amendment number 8, provided some additional contingent appropriations to the master's in counseling, the counselor in education from the community colleges. Now, what this did is we did have a similar amount of $96,828 to participate in that, but what there was in the footnote with respect to that was this is priority number 27 in the 2015 monies, and this removes the matching requirement, so there would be no match, and increased the amount by a like amount, so that it's in this one there is $96,828 times 2. In their amendment, where it was only the 98,828 here, and the Senate position was that it would that plus the community colleges have to match under the Lox amendment. There, you would not there would be no matching, and the other the extra money would be there. Under second amendment number 14 for the Harvey and healthcare financing, what this did is it modified footnote number 20, and what you had in the original footnote, Mr. President, which you find on page 41 of the budget bill, that was we were talking about increasing, and everybody did increase the daily rates. The Harvey Amendment we're talking about here would increase that so that it would not be just a daily rate increase, but it would be more of a sliding scale. And what we're talking about is increasing the rates expended for the more severe and most severe clients, as opposed to a daily rate for all. On the second reading amendment 24, the Walters Amendment, what we did here was we had a similar amendment that was presented in the Senate by my good by this the it was the Anderson Amendment to delete footnote number 8. We defeated that amendment, and in fact, we didn't defeat it. I think that amendment was withdrawn or defeated, one or the other. So there's a difference there. The question would be whether or not those footnotes are whether they're duplicates or not. The next one was second reading amendment 39, the Harshman Amendment. This did exactly the opposite of what the Scott Amendment did. This made the governor's ability to adjust salaries in categories. This restricts it. According to the Scott Amendment, just did the opposite. It expanded that authority. So there's a difference there, obviously. Then what we did in the next one, you look at the Greer, Perkins, Stubbs Amendments. This is about the Evansville Bridge, and we all know what happened to the Evansville Bridge in the Senate. In the Senate, of course, we deleted both the planning money and the construction money. And then... And those amendments did prevail in the House. So there's obviously a difference there. Then in third reading amendment number 10, the Miller Amendment adds a footnote to the geological survey that provides, and what they're trying to do is create a library of the exploration data and put that and consolidate that and keep that in the geologic survey so that's available to anybody who wants to look at it. And so that does that would be similar, kind of similar to what the Oil and Gas Development Commission does, but more extensive because it would be broader. The next one was the Third Reading Amendment number 27, the Harvey Amendment on the Miners Hospital Board. We had some discussion about that, and ultimately there was a determination, I think, a representation made to the Senate that was unnecessary. It was already covered, but nevertheless, there's a difference in the Harvey Amendment that passed there. In the hospital miners board, and expanding or making sure that there's some additional kind of health, rural health care kind of clinic services available, community health center services available through the miners hospital board to qualifying recipients. And then the last one is the third reading amendment 43, which is the Wanser amendment, and that increased legislative per diem. To whatever the federal rates are, and so that actually would increase, would have the effect of increasing per diem rates from 109 to whatever they would be, to 129 would be the amount from 109 to 129, and obviously there was no similar amendment in the Senate. Thank you, Mr. President.
Questions on the non-identical amendments, Senator Landon.
Amendment 3043, the Zwanitzer Amendment just aforementioned, I assume that would be effective immediately as of July 1st of this year coming up. Just trying to make sure.
Senator Perkins?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's exactly right. Since it's a per diem and not a compensation increase, it doesn't have to wait until you're out of office. So that would apply. I don't know if it would be immediately or if it would be July the 1st. I'm not sure. We can sure find that out.
Further questions? Now, folks, there are items that are not listed on these pages because the Senate non-identical amendments, the ones that we have passed that are not identical, are on a separate list that goes to the House. We have that list, but you're only seeing the non-identical House amendments. Senator Scott.
Mr. President, on that point, in the future, for information purposes, so we can track the whole process, I would urge the Appropriations Committee to prepare these next year in particular to include the Senate non-identical ones so we can see the whole picture. I know we won't discuss them in have an opportunity to talk about them. We've already done that. But there's so much goes on, it really, I think, would be a help to us in understanding the whole budget if we saw those on this similar pass out in the future.
Senator Ross.
Mr. President, I can go through the Senate non-identicals really quick if you want.
Why don't you do that? And it's probably a good idea when we get the big budget to It's just it's not that long of a list, but it's we wouldn't have to distribute the entire House package, just the Senate non-identical. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. The first non-identical amendment from the Senate was the Driscoll third reading amendment number 5. It related to the forestry program. It basically gave a 6 month extension to December 31st, 2016 with regards to use of those funds for pine bark beetle. The next non-identical amendment was my amendment. It was Senate amendment, second reading amendment number 11. This goes into the accounting system at the University of Wyoming, and it removed the $3 million match that was initially put on by the JAC. And so basically there's $1 million there for them to begin their accounting system. The next amendment that was not identical was the Von Flatern Amendment regarding aircrafts. We replaced a footnote 17 with new language directing the university to modify the rates it charges for use of the research aircraft in subsequent contracts for purposes of maintenance, replacement of engines, propellers, and aircraft to be deposited into a reserve account and requires a report. The next non-identical amendment was the Christensen Amendment. This had to do with Central Wyoming Community College, the Jackson Outreach. We appropriated $240,000 general fund for the culinary school in Jackson. Huh? The amendment was Senate amendment, second reading amendment number 16, the Christensen amendment. The next amendment was the second reading amendment 22, the Hastert amendment. This goes into tranche 2 with regard to retention incentive payments, and we changed the language so that that is a recurring amount of $1 million. For retention for the University of Wyoming as an incentive. The next set of amendments all deal with what we went through in the Hicks divisions, and essentially what it does is, of course, we got rid of the Jacoby Golf Course, both Tranche 2 and Tranche 3, and we also got rid of the Evansville Bridge appropriations. So that's the difference there. Oh, gosh. You want me to go through all
of them? I'll tell you what, Senator, to answer. So you're going to get, we'll distribute that last page. So I've been looking at the staff behind. So we'll distribute the single non-identical House amendments, and that'll make it easy. So you don't have to take notes.
The next amendment was the Scott Amendment, second reading amendment number 30. This was in regards to the limitation on salary increases. Senator Scott's language gives more flexibility to the governor. The House actually, I think, is even more stringent. They added even more stringent language. The next amendment was Senate second reading amendment number 31, the Hicks Amendment. This was regarding sage-grouse and the sage-grouse implementation team. And it requires a report. That language is modified to include capture and transplant programs to the report. And the last amendment was the Case Amendment, second reading amendment number 43. It's 2016 contingent funds. And this language added by Senator Case allowed for planning, the use of those funds for planning in the case of a disaster. And those are the only amendments.
Huh? Did you miss that? Did you get to
another page?
Oh, yeah, I forgot one, Mr. I forgot one also, which was my amendment. It's a secret. Forgot mine, which was... In the contingent earnings in tranche 2, 2015, we added $325,000 in other funds for level 2 planning for the CWC Ag and Animal Science Center. And that's all of the ones that we did that they didn't do.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. And we'll get a complete list, but there's another page that has three more on it, too. That...
Okay, we're gonna, we've got, so you're going to get two sheets, I guess, on the non-identical sentence. Senator Ross.
The other page was another Von Flatern amendment to transportation at subsections to footnote 10, directing the department to hold, this is the Department of Transportation, to hold public meetings in Douglas, Wright, and Shoshone regarding the condition of Highway 59 and U.S. 2026. The next amendment that they didn't do was a Perkins amendment. This was Perkins's amendment directing the department, the military department, to work with the federal government to secure access to the Evansville via the Veterans Cemetery Bridge or go pound sand. The other amendment was the BBOT amendment, third reading amendment with regards to the next generation science standards. And we included some language to develop quality standards unique to Wyoming, which was different than...
probably be the last amendment you fight over.
That's it, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any further discussion or questions on the report? No questions, no discussions? There being no further discussion, House Bill 1, in accordance with Joint Rule 14-1G, and Joint Rule 14-1H, House Bill 1 is referred directly to a conference committee of 5 members from each House to meet to resolve the differences between the Houses with respect to both budget bills, Senate File 1 and House Bill 1. Do we have any further messages to read in? We'll clear off your desk. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that brings us to the back to bills on consideration of general file. Oh, you want to? There you go.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself back into committee of the whole to continue discussion of bills on general file.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Let me ask you, the Senate appropriations and the leaders, floor leaders, minority, and majority will meet in my office now. Senator Coe, do you have any bills on the first 4 or 5 that are up? You do?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the next bill up.
Senator Case, do you have any bills on the next 4 or 5 up? Would you please take the general file for Senator Wasberger while he's in with... leadership.
Let's get this right for him, then.
Yeah, here are all the scripts.
There you go.
Yeah.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 149. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 149, Special Non-Resident Hunting License Draw, sponsored by Representative Crone. It was referred to Committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Cooper and Kraft, no, Senator Barnard and Johnson, Senator Cooper, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file, or the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Cooper?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 149 do pass. Mr. Chairman, there are no standing committee amendments, and I would ask that you call on Senator Coe for an explanation of the bill.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the Senate, this has to do with non-resident licenses only as it relates to elk, deer, and antelope, and there are really three key points to the bill. There's two things this bill does not do. It has no impact at all on resident hunters, and it in no way changes the number of licenses available to non-resident hunters. It does have the potential to provide nearly $500,000 in additional license revenue to Game and Fish. So I draw your attention, members of the Senate, to a handout I actually distributed on Friday. Don't know if you still have it. It breaks down these non-resident licenses for elk, deer, and antelope, regular license, the special draw that we're going to talk about, youth licenses, and youth cow-calf. I draw your attention to that. So members of the Senate, Wyoming's had a tiered license system for decades. Actually, I was involved in the travel committee back in the 90s when we started this. So for non-resident hunters, they can choose between applying for a regular non-resident license, which is, you'll see, for instance, with elk, would be $577 a year, or a special non-resident license for elk, for instance, which is $1,057 a year. So currently the commission sets aside 40% of the non-resident licenses as special licenses for those harder-to-draw licenses. 60% of the licenses are set aside as regular non-resident licenses. So 40% for the special license, 60% for the regular. The demand for the special license has grown beyond the 40% supply. So what this bill simply does, it reverses the percentages, allowing for 60% special licenses, and 40% regular licenses. I want to emphasize one thing here. This does not change the reduced non-resident youth license. It doesn't change that at all. So it's important to note that the commission has the authority also to roll over any unused licenses. So if 60% special licenses are not applied for, the commission can roll it down to regular licenses, and then even further roll them over to resident licenses. So we're still talking about non-resident licenses here. But that hasn't been the case. There are non-resident, even international hunters who want to hunt in Wyoming and are willing to purchase these special expensive licenses. So I want to have you keep one thing in mind. This does not increase the number of licenses available to non-residents. It doesn't do that. And revenue from non-resident license sales largely help keep our resident hunting licenses fair and reasonable. So you're going to hear arguments that this change will make hunting a rich man's sport, or that this moves us to the European model instead of the North American model. That simply isn't true. Our system allows for hunters to choose at which price point they want to apply, either the regular non-resident licenses or the special one. Over the years here, particularly the last two or three that I remember, we've had numerous bills to increase fees for funding to Game and Fish. And even though the need for funding has been recognized, raising resident licenses was soundly defeated a couple of times. So by reversing the percentage of special and regular licenses, the fees generated from this change, it's estimated, will provide Game and Fish with nearly $500,000 of additional revenue. Many of these non-resident hunters use our local outfitters and guides to help them in their hunt. This bill is a win-win for Wyoming. Now, just a comment about the outfitting industry. And as you might know or not know, I chaired travel for 8 years, and I was involved in the preference point system, putting that in, doing different things. The outfitting industry is having a very difficult time. And I'll just cite my area as an example. With wolves and, you know, particularly wolves, They're moving elk around in places where we've never seen it before. An example of that is straight north of Cody, if you know the Heart Mountain area. We've never had a resident elk herd on Heart Mountain. We've got a herd up there now of 300 to 500. We've seen elk herds out in the middle of the sagebrush. The wolves have moved a lot of these elk around so much that they moved them out of the Sunlight Crandall country, moved them up to a safer habitat, I guess would be a way to say it. So the outfitting industry has suffered. The outfitting industry is having a tough time. I know personally two or three outfitters up in my part of the country that have actually just gone out of business because there just wasn't any hunting left. So I think this is a good bill. It brings a compromise, has the ability to generate some money for game and fish, and has the ability to bring good business to Wyoming. And with that, I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Coe. Questions for the sponsor? Any questions? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of Senator Cooper's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the due pass recommendation on House Bill 149, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 149 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 138, Workers' Compensation for Special Education Teachers. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 138, Workers' Compensation for Special Education Teachers, sponsored by Representative Northrup. It was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 138 do pass. There was no standing committee amendment, and I yield to Senator Coe for an explanation of this good little House bill.
Senator Coe, you're up again.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, twice right away. Just thrills everybody to death, I'm sure. Mr. Chairman, this goes into something that I just couldn't really believe wasn't out there. Special education teachers in our school systems, believe it or not, are not covered by workers' comp. And so that's what this bill does. It's workers' compensation for special education teachers. The gist of this one-pager is on the new language, page 2, and it says, in certified special education teachers and related services, this is to add them, under all those statutes, to provide services to eligible students with behavioral, emotional, cognitive learning, principal, or health disabilities. That's the teachers that deal with these. That require educational services to be provided outside of the regular classroom because the use of supplementary aids and services cannot be achieved satisfactorily. Members of the Senate, what this does, it goes in, and it does not specifically go in and bring all special education teachers into it. If you look at the handout right there, you'll see the top three tiers are the tiers that we're talking about right now. There have been a number of documented cases, some 224 to be exact out there, with problems that have existed. We had a case up in my district where a special education teacher was dealing with a slow learning kid, a special ed kid, and, you know, some of these kids have strength to them, they're strong, and flew off and grabbed this teacher's finger and broke the thumb in three places. And so this is a difficult situation that exists in our schools. If you go to the fiscal note that I've got here, it's projected in the workers' comp fund, $164,114 is what is expected. The staffing data provided by the Department of Education shows 96.92 full-time equivalents in this special education staff area that we're talking about targeting here. And approximately the 96.92 staff members would now be included in the extra hazardous occupation category under this bill. So members of the Senate, that's what it does. I was surprised that they weren't covered. I think it's a good little bill, and I think it deserves your consideration. Ask for an aye vote.
Any questions, any discussion? Senator Scott, we'll go to you first.
Mr. Chairman, first let me say this really is an extra hazardous occupation. We had on Committee 10, three members of the five had family members that were involved in this, had frontline experience, and we had several of them that had injuries. because these kids are, they just don't know what they're doing, and they will do things, and it's a very difficult situation. We have to take care of the kids, and they're not mean or vicious or anything. They just don't understand, and they can do quite a bit of damage. So it really is an extra hazardous occupation. Mr. Chairman, there's a problem here that we explored. What we're doing in this bill is covering the special ed teachers that handle the classrooms that have the most severe kids, where you're most likely to get an accident. And the sponsor did it that way because that's a relatively small change, doesn't get you a great big fiscal note. The trouble is, Mr. Chairman, that it's quite clear to us that really you ought to cover the full realm of the special ed teachers, because they're all at some risk. And that's a much larger number. And when you do that, you'll have a base rate, the way workers' comp works. You'll have a base rate, it's currently 3-something percent, that applies to all the salary that comes in, and you'll gradually adjust it in the course of 2 or 3 years to what the real risk is. But if you cover the most dangerous ones first, and we're already started down that road with the aides that are covered now, then you'll have a high base rate, and when you cover the whole lot of them, you'll have to put up with that high base rate for 2 or 3 years until the experience rating can modify it down to where it really belongs. We're probably better off, if you think we want to cover everybody eventually, to do that right now and have a lesser base rate that we're dealing with. I think it'll still adjust down to what the real risks are. But I think it'll cost us less to implement and be less of a shock if we do the whole thing that we ought to right now. So, Mr. Chairman, what the Labor Committee decided to do is pass the bill out as is. We're preparing an amendment on second reading to take it to all the special ed teachers, all the people that are involved, so that we cover the full risk. And that will be a larger hit on the school foundation program for a couple of years, but long-term, I think we'll wind up money ahead. And all these teachers, Mr. Chairman, are at an enhanced risk. But we thought it would be best to do that. Number one, we didn't have the language for the amendment when we were in committee. But number two, we'll want to bring it in on second reading. It will have big financial implications for the school foundation. So we'll want to bring it in with a roll call, and that way I think we won't jeopardize the bill, which is very much needed. But if we can convince you it's a good idea, we'll get the whole job done properly, and I think cheaper in the long run. And these teachers, you know, they don't go sue, which I suppose they could, but they're public employees. And they are really getting hurt when they get one of these injuries on the job. And we need to do something about it, Mr. Chairman. It's a classic thing that workers' comp is intended for. So that's what's coming on this bill. And want to get your thinking started on it.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I cannot even begin to answer whether the financial implications of others, but I do have a question on this. On line 9, it says on page 2, services to be provided outside of the regular classroom. Can somebody give me a definition of what that means? I mean, in the school, they're not covered, but if they go outside the school, is that what that means?
Senator Scott? Mr. Chairman, you have to require some of these severe students need an aid from the minute they're come outside the home, whether it's in a wheelchair or otherwise. they are put on a school bus. There's risks for the people that are loading them on the school bus. The aides are present with them outside the classroom if they're involved in any kind of activity, and just in the mechanics of getting them home, and you have risks for injuries in those settings, and this language makes sure that we're covered in those settings.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator von Fleitern.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I just think it should be an and that also provide, or we will cover those who provide services outside of the classroom. Because the way I read it, unless you're providing services outside the regular classroom, you're covered outside the regular, but in the regular classroom, you're not covered. And I may not know some other part of the statute that I'm missing at the moment, but that's the way I read this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Anderson, did you have?
Yes, thank you. First of all, I'm going to say this is a necessary bill, and I do support it. I want a little more conversation in regard to teaching aides, teacher aides, those people that help so often. Special education has a high population of aides that work with these teachers, and they, in my opinion, are just in as much of a danger as those teachers that are addressed in here. And also, these aides are the ones that many times go downtown for occupational therapy, go outside the classroom, and that. So in an attempt not to expand necessarily population, attempt now is to expand the conversation and how that was included in this discussion.
Thank you, Senator Thank Anderson. You. Who can help with these questions? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the aides are covered now, and the amendment, if we expand it to everybody, should cover all the special ed personnel and everything they do for these students, Mr. Chairman. And that's important because the risks are present whether you're doing something in the classroom or outside the classroom. And you do see these on activities, for instance, outside the classroom. I've seen teachers with some of the special ed groups in the grocery store trying to teach them. These are the ones that are pretty severely involved, trying to teach them enough about how you buy and pay for things in a grocery store so they have a chance to function independently. And you do get that kind of activity with the special ed, Mr. Chairman, and it ought to be covered.
Senator Scott, can you answer the question about the raised by Senator von Fleitern about whether that should be an or?
Mr. Chairman, I don't quite have an answer to his question. I'll have to figure that out. I know the amendment we're working on would remove the problem and cover them both ways.
Okay, perhaps you can get there. Senator von Fleitern.
Quickly, Mr. Chairman, on line 8 after disabilities, if we added including those that require educational services, that would include that area outside too.
Thank you, Senator. Anything else on the bill today? Anything else on the bill today? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 138, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 138 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 139.
House Bill number 139, Unemployment Compensation Protest Time Limits, sponsored by Representative Pretoff. It was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report it to so the recommendation that House Bill 139 do pass. There were no standing committee amendments, and I yield to Senator Anderson, 28, for an explanation of the House bill.
James Lee Anderson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill changes the amount of time an employer or employee has to protest a determination made by the unemployment division. A determination about whether an employee qualifies for unemployment benefits presently becomes final unless there is an appeal filed within 15 days. That is 15 total days, not 15 business days, so that's 2 weeks, not 3 weeks. All of this is done via U.S. mail service. The notice of determination and the response to that determination. This has always been a time crunch issue, but has gotten progressively worse. 28 days was selected, so if someone is on a two-week vacation, it still gives them time for the notice to arrive and be returned. And you'll see in the bill, we've gone in and changed it from 15 days to 28 days in every place that there was a need. There's about 4 to 5 places that it's been changed. It's a simple bill. Just change it to 28 days. I encourage your support of House Bill 138.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. Discussion on the bill? Discussion on the bill? Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a do-pass recommendation on House Bill 139, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 139 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for consideration is House Bill 107.
House Bill number 107, Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, sponsored by Representative Wilson. It was referred to Committee number 10, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file or the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Scott just walked out the door, so somebody's got to move this bill. Senator Landon, thanks for jumping in.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation, House Bill 107, and I'll be glad to walk you through line by line of this 50-page bill.
Go right ahead, Senator Landon, but if you have a better idea, you might take it up.
Say that again, Mr. Chairman.
Whatever you'd like to do, Senator Landon.
Has it been read in?
Yes, sir. All you got to do is move the bill that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, these medical practice acts or interstate compact bills, I thought, Mr. Chairman, that I really should defer to my good friend from Cheyenne because the good senator is usually the one that carries. We'll get started. Mr. Chairman, the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, you keep looking at our chairman. Do you need to go to the chairman for something?
No, sir. You're fine.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, let's launch it. Let's launch in. And, Mr. Chairman, I promise I won't go line by line. But I do want to let you know a little bit about this Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. I was fortunate enough to be in the committee room. Gosh, it must have been 4 or 5 years ago, and the good chairman and the late Senator Schiffer, as a matter of fact, were conversing with the director of our State Board of Medicine, and we were talking about the issue of licensure and why it took so long to license some of our folks, some of our physicians, and the issue of crossing state lines, et cetera. Well, I'm proud of our folks here in Wyoming because they took that and ran with it, Mr. Chairman, and they actually have spent the last couple of years working very hard on this compact legislation. It's an ability, Mr. Chairman, to expedite some of the processes. And I want to tell you real quickly three different things about this bill and set the stage, and then we'll go into the bill real quickly. The compact, participation in this compact is voluntary for our physicians. It creates a new process. It modifies reciprocity to expedite licensing for qualified physicians interested in practicing in multiple states. It creates another pathway for medical licensure, but does not otherwise change a state's existing Medical Practice Act. The physicians can still get licensed through the regular processes. Each participating state appoints 2 members to the commission. This bill, House Bill 107, you'll find that late in the bill where we ask the governor to make an appointment of those 2 people. It allows our states to exchange information to track and investigate the physicians. Here's what the compact can do for Wyoming. It expands on our ability, our Board of Medicine's ability, and the existing expedited licensure that we can do now, and it helps small community hospitals and clinics recruit physicians and address emergency staffing situations. It encourages the rapidly expanding practice of telemedicine, especially by out-of-state physicians who must have a Wyoming medical license to treat patients via telemedicine in Wyoming. This way, Mr. Chairman, they can hold licenses in multiple states and do so in a much easier fashion. The compact would not cause changes to Wyoming Medical Practice Act. The compact would not come with significant cost to our state to either join or participate in. The compact would not change the statutory definition of physician as it presently applies in the Wyoming Medical Practice Act. Mr. Chairman, that's a quick overview of what the compact is, what the benefits are to Wyoming, and what it would not do. Real quickly, I do want to point out some things in the bill, Mr. Chairman, and then I will, once I get through, I'd be glad to try to answer any questions. Before I do that, I do want to point out that there's a lot of information that has been provided to you on this medical licensure compact. There are two different handouts. If you would please take a look at those at your leisure, that should answer a lot of questions on this, Mr. Chairman. If you go to House Bill 107, the purpose of this compact is outlined in page 2 and 3. We have a lot of definitions in this bill. That's the nature of compact bills. Compact bills tend to be long and legal, and so we begin that process 5, 6, and 7. 3 through 8, and then on 5, 6, and 7, we define what a physician is. We talk about the eligibility for licensure on page 8. The state of principal license is taken care of right after that. License application and the expedited process begins at the top of page 11. The renewal process on page 14, the compact itself and coordinated information system, we talk about that on page 16, 17, and 18. The discipline processes, we outline that on three different pages, 18, 19, 20. The makeup of the medical license compact, page 22, and that's where we spell out the two representatives from each state. It talks about the officers of the compact as well. Sideboards are brought in on page 24 and 25. The duties and the powers of the commission, 26 through 30. How are we going to pay for it? And the assessments are brought in on page 30, 31. The organization and operation, the immunity provisions, 31 through 34. Rulemaking on page 35. The enforcement. Default, 37, 38, and 39, rather, Mr. Chairman. We can withdraw from this compact at any time. That's on page 43, 44. Wyoming-specific language on pages 47 and 48. That talks about how the governor is going to make these appointments. Mr. Chairman, I scooted through the bill very quickly because I want to make sure that we have an opportunity, if there are any questions, we can try to answer those. Again, I commend you to the bill, fellow senators, because of the work that's been done by our State Board of Medicine. This has been a nationwide effort. It's something that's made possible by the Compact Clause of the United States Constitution, and that allows states to come together and address shared interests, Mr. Chairman. I think that's important to know, and it allows states to preserve and exercise their authority, which we do. We spell out very carefully that principal state of residence. You've got to have that. The ability for us to track these positions state by state or interstate, that's very important. I think covers a lot of things, and I think it's pretty well crafted, Mr. Chairman. So I'll stop there and be glad to try to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Page 30, finance powers.
The Interstate Commission may levy on and collect an annual assessment from each member state to cover the costs of operations activities of the Interstate Commission and its staff. And that's going to be determined by the Commission, the formula. I'm just wondering, there's probably other states in this, I'm just wondering what they levy right now to each state. And, you know, I think that the greatest benefit comes to the individuals, the physicians, that are a member of the compact, because it gives them flexibility to operate in this state, or if they don't like the weather, they can move any place they want to that is a compact state, and essentially have their license across all the different compact states. So I'm just wondering why we're paying for it and why the individual members aren't paying for it, and what the formula is, or whether, how far we've gotten down this road, or if anybody knows how much it's going to cost the state, because we have no say in what it's going to be. We don't have any say in whether they live in a Taj Mahal or whether they use private jets to travel in between the states. You know, I mean, there's no controls whatsoever. So, you know, I think compact, Mr. Chairman, is probably by itself not a bad idea, but I just don't like, you know, I guess letting someone else have taxing authority.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me get everything arranged. I find interstate compacts very fascinated. I've worked and gotten several through the legislature. My questions, first of all, is this compact in process, or has it been approved by Congress? They have to be approved by Congress before you can actually be an official one, and if so, how many states are in it now? Another thing that's quite interesting about compacts is, essentially we can't amend this. It has to be all the same in all of the states, and they all work that way no matter which compact you're talking about. The old ones like the Colorado River Compact, or the new ones, I think the last one we did was for the, children of the military, and I know that you all remember that. As far as paying for them, the commissions, which have membership from all of the states, figure out how much that is and assess it to the state. That's been going on, as far as I know, forever, and it seems to work. Our commissioners would be very careful on how much we have to pay here, because I know the type of people the governor would appoint to this. So I'll sit down and get the answers to my questions.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Speaking a little bit to my friend from the Far East with regard to funding, the testimony in our committee was that there are no upfront costs to enter this interstate license compact, and the intention is for those members to put the bill. Part of I cannot tell you that it's never going to cost us anything, because we are going to ask people from Wyoming to sit on this compact. Any operating costs and the funding sources for those costs must be approved by those commissioners. But then anything and everything related to this compact must be approved by the legislature and the governor of Wyoming before anything can be spent. And so, you know, it'll come right back to us. If there's ever a request for any funding at all, Mr. Chairman, it would come to this body and we would consider it. I guess I envision that might mean some travel money or something so that we could sit on this board. But I think the intention is for it to really pay for itself. I'm going to defer to the chairman of our labor committee with regard to the compact in progress and the question from our Laramie County Senator.
Mr. Chairman, first, with regard to the funding experience elsewhere, we may well be the first state on this one. It's under consideration in a number of legislatures. We were very much involved in drafting this, our Board of Medicine. So we can't give you experience from elsewhere because there isn't any yet. My expectation would be, to the extent they can't recover their costs from fees from the physicians that actually benefit from it, that we would then turn around and appropriate out of the license fees that go to fund the State Board of Medicine any addition. That would be first place you'd look for, because this is benefiting a particular class. It'll benefit all of us in terms of making it easier to bring physicians in from out of state. With regard to the question on the status of the compact, this is an interesting experience in how lawyers can change things. The last clause of Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution says, Mr. Chairman, no state shall, without consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state, etc. I questioned that, and they said, oh, this one doesn't need approval of Congress, doesn't need. And I said, how can that be? The language is pretty explicit. And I got a collection of legal documents citing some Supreme Court cases where they've decided where these compacts are involved in matters where the Congress has no jurisdiction anyhow, which it doesn't in something like medical licensure. You don't need the consent of Congress, and they've gotten court approval on this. It's amazing how the lawyers can change what you think is the plain language of something. But that's the status of this one. And they added one in the discussion that given what goes on in Washington right now, that's the last place they want to go. If you want something effective, you need to stay out of Washington. But apparently the Supreme Court has allowed compacts of this nature without the consent of Congress, in spite of the language in the Constitution. And Mr. Chairman, it's a sad commentary maybe on the State of the Union, but I think we would be wise not to argue with it on this one, because they're right about the state of what goes on in Washington and the problems that that would entail. And this does make a lot of sense in terms of improving the health care in the state of Wyoming and the availability of physicians to deliver that health care.
Mr. Chairman, with regards to the cost of the program, you know, our architectural licensing happens in 54 states and territories. So it happens routinely right now. And now it's through a state, the National Council of Architectural Registration Boards, but so it's not a compact. But the cost of it is borne by the licensee. So while the state board of architects here in Wyoming does pay for belonging to the National Council of Architects Registration Boards, it's a state check gets sent or a voucher, or somehow the state pays, but it doesn't come out of the general fund. It comes out of the licensing fees. So I would expect that this would be revenue neutral to the state. It would come from the fees that physicians pay to whoever administers the contract within the compact within the state. So I don't have a problem or a fear that it's going to impact us monetarily. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all well and fine. Maybe that should be the very first draft for the next legislation, is to make sure that that's the way it's going to be, that it is revenue neutral to the state, and the people that are actually getting the benefit of it are paying for it. Because it's not in statute today, but I don't think we could modify this compact. Of course, it is the first one. I guess we've got free crack at it, Mr. Chairman.
House Bill 107 passed committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 197.
House Bill number 197, Emergency Vehicle, Tow Trucks, and Wreckers, sponsored by Senate Representative Edmonds. It was referred to Committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, Military Affairs, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Emmerich, Escobel, Johnson, and Meyer. Senator Meyer, Chairman.
I've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee in the whole rise to report, that it do so with a do-pass motion on House Bill 197, Emergency Vehicles, Tow Trucks, and Wreckers. And for an explanation of this bill, I yield to the excellent Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 197, Emergency Vehicles, Tow Trucks, and Wreckers, is, and you've heard it before, it's a simple bill. There's no fiscal impact. And basically what it calls for is it expands the definition of authorized emergency vehicles to include tow trucks and wreckers. As you all know, when you come across a highway, you're driving down the highway, and you see an ambulance, a police car, fire engine, those kind of emergency vehicles. You slow down and you move to the left and you defer to their emergency. Well, in this case, this bill basically puts tow trucks and wreckers in that same category. If assuming they're on the job. They're at a scene where there's a wrecked, disabled, or stalled motor vehicle. You treat them the same way you would an emergency vehicle, ambulance, police car, et cetera, et cetera. And it does put some conditions on the wreckers, the tow truck individuals. It's got to be equipped with a flashing red and blue lamp visible from 500 feet in front of and behind the vehicle. And in addition to any other equipment or lights required or authorized by law. And that's basically what it does, Mr. Chairman, is it just puts wreckers and tow trucks in the definition of emergency vehicles so that you give them a little bit of room. And that's basically it. It doesn't give the wreckers or the tow trucks all of the authority of emergency vehicles. But it does when they're on the scene and working on a disabled or wrecked automobile, things of that nature. And that's basically it. If there's any questions, I'll try to answer them.
On House Bill 197, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 197 is passed committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is the next bill resolution for our consideration is House Joint Resolution 6.
House Joint Resolution 6, Wyoming Local Food Production, sponsored by Representative Berger. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Christensen, Dockstader, Emmerich, and Geis. Senator Emmerich, Vice Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the resolution. What is your pleasure, Senator Emmerich?
Mr. Chairman, I move when your committee of the whole rise to report it do so with favorable
favor two, with a due pass on House Joint Resolution 6, Wyoming local food production, and for the explanation of this, I refer to the senator from Sheridan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Chairman. Lady and gentlemen of the Senate, House Joint Resolution 6 is a little bit a step back from something that's legally binding, given that it is a resolution, as opposed to House Bill 56, which is the locally grown foods bill. And this simply expresses the same sentiment that we've heard discussed on HB 56, which is the trying to encourage the and urging the state and others within the state to do what they can to help promote farmers markets, local agricultural markets, farm-to-market programs where there's value added by local producers. And we've seen quite a little bit of that in Sheridan, in my district, and I'm sure that if you're not familiar with it, you probably wouldn't have to look too far to find it in your own districts. In my district, our local farms and ranches are providing locally grown food to our hospital, to our school districts, to local restaurants, dude ranches, and to individuals. And it's across the spectrum, and it's year-round. Hot houses and hoop houses are helping to do that. And then local beef is being processed in Montana or South Dakota and then brought back into state so that it can be locally marketed. And we're happy to say that we have received some cooperation from supermarkets and such. And then we also, just a sampling of some of the things that salad greens, tomatoes, green beans, carrots, zucchini, raspberries, eggplants, peppers. And so this farmer's market is a great convening place for so many of these things, and we continue to try and develop what are currently micro markets. And this urges that on, as well as urges the cooperation of the state in that process as well. So a quick overview of the resolution. The whereas is talking about the benefits are very well familiar. On page 3, section 1 is the declaration of the legislature that we recognize the benefits of locally grown foods. Section 2, urging by this body cooperation and support from all the Wyoming executive agencies and educational institutions. And then on page 4, section 3, which is that we support initiatives that encourage development of things such as cottage foods, food hubs, independent livestock feeding operations, and so forth. And then section 4 asking that copies of this resolution be communicated to all appropriate stakeholders. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Kinski. Any questions on this joint resolution? Any questions? All those in favor of Senator Emmerich's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Joint Resolution 6. Please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Joint Resolution 6 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 180.
House Bill number 180, Child Interviews, Neglect and Abuse Cases, sponsored by Representative Crone. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Flatter, and Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, could I have committee or privilege of the floor first?
Certainly you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the legislature, I'd like to point out our county treasurer, standing up here, you'd stand up, Donna. This lady is just one of the superstars of Teton County and an innovator to boot. She actually came up with the idea that maybe we ought to auction off our top 100 low-number license plates. I objected. I thought it'd be a lot of work for her staff, but I want to celebrate her for thinking outside the box. Thank you, Donna.
Here, here. Welcome to the Senate. Okay, Senator Christensen, let's see if you can think out of the box.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the Committee of the Whole rises to report, I move that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 180, Child Interviews with Neglect and Abuse Cases. And to present this nice bill is Senator Landon.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Today, fellow senators, House Bill 180 gives us an opportunity to talk about an operation that we happen to have in my community, Children's Advocacy Centers. And we have them in Teton County and here in Laramie County as well. And those three centers affect most of our counties throughout the state. But I want to talk a little bit about what they are, and if you have not had an opportunity to visit those centers, I sure hope that you will in the future. I want to read you a mission statement from the Children's Advocacy Project in our community. I think that'll help to kind of set the stage for what this bill is all about, Mr. Chairman. The Children's Advocacy Project is a team of committed agencies and individuals who work together to provide coordinated forensic and comprehensive services for alleged victims of child abuse and neglect in order to minimize trauma to children, to break the cycle of abuse, and to foster a more effective and efficient community response to child maltreatment. We're also, fellow senators, going to talk about, among all of this information, which is some of it is difficult, but I want to help you understand what a forensic interview is, because it's central to the bill as well. A forensic interview is what these children's advocacy projects do, and here's what an FI is all about. It minimizes trauma. It is designed to maximize the information. The forensic interviewers are trained to interview children at the appropriate developmental level and at a comfortable pace to allow the child to tell as much as they can about a given event. It minimizes contamination, Mr. Chairman. The forensic interviewer uses questions that gather factual information and avoids questions that may lead or influence a child's memory of the event, thus allowing that forensics interview DVD recording to be used later during a trial. It also, a forensics interview, also maintains integrity. It is the intent of the interviewer and the nationally accepted interview protocol to put the child at ease, and if a disclosure is made, to help the child feel empowered with their decision to tell. So, Mr. Chairman, that is the mission of our Children's Advocacy Centers, and also gives you a little bit of insight as to what these forensic interviews are all about. What House Bill 180 attempts to do, fellow senators, is to go into our protection law and to put up a little bit more sideboards around this development of and this recording of those interviews, those forensic interviews that take place. Let's go to the bill real quickly, Mr. Chairman. As you can see at the bottom of page one, our protection chapter under section one, we're going to develop a new subsection with House Bill 180, and that takes place over on page two. We have to, in paragraph B, we allude to the new section, but down at the bottom is the complete development of the new paragraph, carrying over onto page three. And, Mr. Chairman, this is the guts of the bill, so I want to read it to make sure that we all know what we're doing with this bill. No information, including those recorded interviews that I alluded to, of the child, shall be disclosed to any person in any civil proceeding not related to an abuse or neglect case brought under this article, except upon order of the court, which shall determine if disclosure of the information requested is essential to justice. Any order granting disclosure shall include appropriate protections against further dissemination in any form. The court may conduct an in-camera review of the information requested and shall consider alternatives to production of a copy of any interview with the child to prevent further dissemination, including but not limited to the three provisions that you see on page 3. The court can deny the request for production. The court can require counsel to certify that no copies of the interview shall be made available to their client if only counsel is allowed to review the interview, or allowing a recording to be presented to counsel and their client without making the copy available. Fellow senators, what this is really all about, and I want to make sure that you understand, there are three different ways, three different sorts of cases that these interviews might come into play. The criminal, in juvenile court, but what we're talking about with this bill is just in civil court, which could be in a child custody case, for example. And what brought this bill about is this idea and technology where it is, this idea that there is a recording of this very difficult, very sensitive interview. And there was a case up in the Northwest where an attorney for someone already in state prison was able to request a copy of this DVD, and the Children's Advocacy Project up in our neck of the woods, Mr. Chairman, was not able to block the release of that DVD. I have not been able to confirm this, but I've been told by a reputable source that this happened back east, and one of these interviews ended up on YouTube. Excuse me. Ended up, Mr. Chairman, on an internet service. I can't think of much that is more mortifying to me. And frankly, fellow senators, that is central to why I signed on to this bill. I've toured this facility twice, and when they get upstairs, Mr. Chairman, the gates will be open for the work that they do in that place. This bill has some sideboards. There's no question about it. What it says is we're going to protect that interview as best we can. We're not going to limit folks from having access to it, but what we're trying to do is to limit the dissemination of that very sensitive and very special interview. And, Mr. Chairman, that is essentially the bill. There's more that we can share, and I'll do my best to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First question I have is on line 17. On page 2. The information requested is essential to justice. I have no idea what that means, and I would defy anybody here to tell me what that means. It's not even a standard that you would normally see, so I have some serious question about that. Maybe somebody has a better idea. The other thing that I have a problem with is Romanet 2 on page 3, which is in reference to requiring the counsel to certify that no copies of the interview shall be made available to their client. That's problematic, folks. I have a duty as an attorney to share with my client all evidence. And I think it puts attorneys in a really bad place in terms of violating the rules of ethics with regards to that. And so I'd like some discussion about those two things.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the second topic, what we were told, and that came up in our committee meeting, and what was explained to us from the sponsor, the House sponsor was that while there are those three conditions, those are certainly not the only ones, and as the language at the bottom of line or bottom of page 2 talks about, to consider different alternatives, and it was explained that that would include or could include that the accused gets to watch it too, but it's really about having access to a copy that could be reproduced.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Referring to the good senator's question regarding line 17, I understand that that was discussed at some length as well in the committee meeting, and I would submit to you that it is a high bar. I'm not of the legal profession, so I don't know if that is a standard or not. But I do know that I like the language. I like it a lot better than suggested language that I have heard or that has been presented in front of the committee. I frankly can't think of anything that I'd rather protect more than what we're talking about today. And if it needs to be essential to justice in order for us to develop a copy of that DVD and hand it out, that's fine by me, because to me, in my mind, that puts that bar up there quite a ways, and it should be up there quite a ways. By the way, just a couple of points of reference, folks. 90% of these interviews are related to sexual abuse. And the average age, Mr. Chairman, of those young people who come in to go through this process is 9 years old. And that's some pretty sobering stuff, and I think it underscores our need to do whatever we can to help these centers, which, by the way, represent the best protocols that we've come up with nationwide. Many states out there, fellow senators, have written into their statutes this process. We have not yet done that here in Wyoming. These nonprofits are not... they're not state agencies. They're not considered part of the state government. But in many states, they are. This is protocol nationwide. This is the best stuff that we know what we're doing here. And anyway, Mr. Chairman, I guess the answer to that question is, yeah, I think that is a pretty high bar. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Senator Esquibel.
Chairman, in regard to the question that was asked about what essential to justice meant, the question was asked in committee, and basically the answer we got was that to some extent it was synonymous with good cause. And I suspect that, based on the discussions that were held, I suspect that an amendment will be forthcoming on second reading that will address that particular issue. That's the impression I got from the sponsor and from a member of an attorney profession that had some questions on whether essential to justice or good cause was more appropriate, whether that terminology. So it might be addressed on second reading. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to the bill, and I guess this is one of the concerns that we have to address. I think when we go down this road, I think you have to be careful. When we look at this bill, what you're saying here is no information, including the recorded interviews of the child, shall be disclosed to any person in any civil proceeding not related to abuse or neglect case brought under this article, except under order of the court, which shall determine if the disclosure of the information requested is essential to justice. Keep in mind that probably, and since we're not talking about criminal cases right now, in a criminal case, obviously this wouldn't apply to a criminal case, and it could be disclosed and would be disclosed in a criminal case unless there's another provision that doesn't do this. But you're talking about a civil case. Well, what civil case would this be in? The most likely civil case in this is going to be a termination of parental rights or a custody determination. And if the good senator who practices in this area wants to correct me on that, he certainly can, because I don't practice in this area, but just looking at this from from my perspective, is at the end of the day, I think it's fairly problematic in the due process and with respect to your liberty interest that you have in the custody of your children and even maybe even having your parental rights terminated about not having this disclosed unless the court does that. So you come down to this requested essential to justice. You know, that's a really different bar, Mr. Chairman. Usually one of the way that the courts do this is through the rules of evidence. They call it more prejudicial than probative, and it's a sliding scale saying that you look at this evidence, and ultimately if it's more prejudicial, if it's more prejudicial to the victim because it's so personal and not very probative to the facts related to the child custody or the termination of parental rights, then it's a sliding scale. And if it's more prejudicial to that case and it's probative to that case, then the court can exclude that type of evidence. But that's usually the type of scale you're talking about and not something that is this essential to justice. The other thing that you've got in this that goes on is when you look back, there's about three of the most sacrosanct, maybe four sacrosanct privileges that we have under our law. One is a spousal exception. You can't be forced to talk against, to testify against your spouse for things that happened while you were married. Another one is the clergy penitent type of thing. You can't be the clergyman, the priest, or the clergyman can't be forced to testify about things that are talked about in confession or counseling, those types of things. The physician patient is another one. It's very, 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 very specific about physician-patient privileges. And the kind of the fourth one that's really up there is the attorney-client privilege. Because ultimately the attorney doesn't represent the court. The attorney represents his client. Now, he's an officer of the court, and he has to make sure that the laws and the rules of the procedures, he can't suborn perjury. If he knows that things are, that someone's telling a lie, there's some restrictions there. But ultimately, his duty, he has an unfettered duty to his client to act within the law to represent his client's interest. And so that now you're putting the attorney in the place where now the attorney seems to be acting as the gatekeeper to a client that he owns, to someone that he owns undivided loyalty to under the laws and the canons that govern the profession of attorneys. And so as we do this, you know, we need to be very careful about how we do this. And if this bill moves forward, it needs to get fit. It needs to be changed to some degree to allow for those things to work. Because putting this into law right now, while none of us have much sympathy for those who truly abuse children, we should be very, very careful about the due process rights, particularly because we're going to be talking about custody and parental termination issues. And those are significant due process rights to make sure that individuals are entitled to have all the things to have discovery. They get to have the information. They get to have potential for cross-examination. They get to know all the facts that come before them. And to then say that you can view it and you're free to talk about it and describe exactly what happened in your view. So you can talk, you can see it and you can talk about it and know about it, but you can't have a copy of it, is a really fine line. It's a particular gray area that putting anyone in that position is going to be very, very difficult, particularly in light of an attorney-client privilege.
Any further discussion? Senator Landon.
Thank you. I really appreciate the discussion, and I think you know the appreciation I have for my good friends in the legal profession, and very good points made. I certainly would be very willing to take a look at anything we can do to make this language better. But I will say this about the bill. Regarding the paragraphs on page 3, the qualifier, as the good chairman pointed out, comes at the bottom of page 2. Interview with the child to prevent further dissemination, including but not limited to. So anything that we put on page 3, we're not limited to any of that. But I do, I do think that when we say that no copies of the interview shall be made, the whole idea here is to make sure that recording does not walk out onto the street. And, you know, and that's the policy question in front of us with House Bill 180. So, Mr. Chairman, very happy to take a look at this as we move forward. I would hope you would move the bill forward. I think it has great merit, and I would encourage an aye vote on House Bill 180. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Question being called? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 180, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
House Bill 180 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 150. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill number 150, Arrest for Violation of Probation, sponsored by Representative Crone.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
I've got to read the... Oh. It was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary, reports with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senator Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinsey, Von Fladen, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Thank you, sir. You've heard the reading of the bill. Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 150, Arrests for Violation of Probation. And there are no amendments. To present that bill, I would ask you to call on Senator Coe.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 150, what it really does, it gives law enforcement the authority to make probation arrests immediately rather than having to go to court for approval. Currently, an officer would have to go back to court to get authority to make the arrest. That could take several days or weeks. This bill gives arrest authority for probation violations just like a new crime. It's a probable cause standard. I want to emphasize most other states already have this authority for officers. What's the outcome of this bill? It makes the judicial system a little more efficient. It has the potential to allow for offenders to get to court sooner. It provides immediate consequences for violations. And it provides additional protections for victims of violent crimes, including domestic battery, because officers can make immediate arrests. That's what the bill does. The House didn't tinker with it at all. I think it's cut and dried, and I think it's a good little two-page bill, and urge your support.
Any further discussion on House Bill 150? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 150, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no? House Bill 150 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 126. Would the reader clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 126, Candidate Filing Requirements, sponsored by Representative Throne. It was referred to Committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hicks, Meyer, Pappas, and Scott. No, Senator Case, Senator Case, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee number 2, Appropriations, who reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 126, Candidate Filing Requirements. For an explanation of the bill, I ask that you yield to Senator Pappas.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is about candidate filing requirements, something near and dear to most people on this floor. If you'll turn to page 2, all of the guts of the bill are page 2, lines 2 through 13. If a candidate has formed a candidate's committee, campaign committee, the committee may file reports required by this section on behalf of the candidate. If the candidate provides a signed document one time in each election cycle authorizing the committee to file reports on behalf of the candidate and attesting that the facts provided in the report are accurate. If the committee has filed a required report on behalf of a candidate under this subsection, the candidate shall not be required to separately file a report, provided that the candidate shall remain individually responsible for any deficiencies in the report filed by the committee. Basically, what this does, this language allows a candidate to not file a candidate report if his committee is filing a candidate committee report. Most candidate campaign committee reports filed have all the data in it, and so when the candidate goes to file the report, it's basically zero. And so all this does is keeps the candidate from having to make that unnecessary paperwork if his or her committee is going to file on behalf of the candidate. So it's pretty simple, straightforward. Helps candidates that are running for office not forget to file the reports if their committee does so in their stead. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Further questions? Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, because just about every one of us have run into this, I think. And it really is a headache. So I love the bill, and we'll love it even more if we can be assured that we still have the transparency. And what I was told during the interim is that maybe in our software system down in the Secretary of State's office, can they connect it up? Because you sure don't want somebody to come and try to find you and not be able to. So maybe the sponsor could assuage my fears on that front. Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Yes, and I failed to get to Section 2. There is an appropriation tied to this, and basically it's money required to modify the computer program in the Secretary of State's office so that there is that transparency. We discussed in committee about, well, what happens if we don't change it? We just simply tell the Secretary of State's office to, you know, not penalize any candidate that doesn't file. Well, that can't happen, because people will go online and look for reports and not find it. So the computer program has to change so that it would identify that person did not have to file a report because his committee did, or his or her committee did. So it'll be taken care of, and there is an appropriation required to change the software to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions or discussions on House Bill 126? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 126, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 126 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 11. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill Number 11, Distance Education Task Force, sponsored by the Education Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, O2, Cole, Dockstader, Pappas, and Rothfuss, Senator Co-Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, moving the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 11, Distance Education Task Force. Members of the Senate, and further, Mr. Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Amendment. Ask that be read in at this time.
House Bill 11, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 1, line 13.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this, and I'm not a task force fan, but we're going into recalibration. So this is brought to you by the Joint Education Interim Committee, understanding full well that we know we're going to have to look at distance education when we recalibrate the K-12 prototypical funding model. So that's what this task force is created to do. Now, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll go first because it starts on page 1 and 2. The House, as you can see on page 1 and 2, they created this task force of some 14 members. It goes all the way down page 2, and it goes down page 3 to line 14. What the Standing Committee Amendment does, it takes that task force out as it's enumerated there with all the 14 different members and inserts one new paragraph 6 on page 4 after line 33, guidance to ensure compliance with the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's what the task force that we took out numbered up to, and that's what the Standing Committee Amendment's about, and I'd ask that you support the Standing Committee Amendment. Call for the vote on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Any discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment? Question being called. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 11, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We are back. We have passed the Standing Committee Amendment. We are back on the bill. Senator Coe.
Chairman, starting on the bottom of page 3, so what do we have left? We have a task force out there that can be put together by the Department of Education. And it says the task force shall review distance education programs on the bottom of page 3 in paragraph B in cooperation with Wyoming school districts, students in grades kindergarten through 12. After that, it goes on to say the task force shall compile a report containing recommendations for the following. Moving to page 4. Programmatic requirements, paragraph 2, little I, guidance to ensure compliance with statewide education standards, paragraph 3, little I, consultation with the Professional Teaching Standards Board, paragraph 4 on page 4, a review of distance education that can be used to provide greater transparency and accounting for administering distance education, paragraph 5, has a requirement for partnership agreements if necessary. Moving over to Section 2 on page 5, commencing June 15, 2015, departments shall provide monthly progress reports to LSO, and then they distribute those reports to the appropriate legislative committees. And then on October 15, 2015, the final report documenting the recommendations of the task force to LSO for distribution to appropriate legislative committees. And that could include the recalibration committee, because that's what this is really about. As we go into the recalibration process, I want to emphasize this task force is to help the recalibration effort that's going to take place in the interim starting right after this session. In Section 3, there's a $50,000 appropriations in there. With that, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill, and I'd stand for questions. I think there's another standing committee amendment. Maybe not. No, there isn't. Okay.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions. And essentially what you've done is you've taken out all of the different types of people that should be there, and you've left it up to the state superintendent on who she wants and how big she wants to be, and I guess that was the intent of that. But when you talk about recalibration, and that's what we'll be doing, why do we need to have reports from the Department of Ed, wouldn't that be part of what you would be doing anyway? Or maybe it's because this is something different than you need some help on, or I'm trying to figure out what they're going to provide you every month that you wouldn't be doing normally through the recalibration process. And then, of course, if the money goes until June 30th of 2016, your report's going to be 2015. I wonder why the money continues past the date of the report. Is there some reason why you did that? Because it seems to me that if you want the report to be able to help on your recalibration, you'd want it done by the 15th of October. yet you want the money to be around till the next June. So is there other work you want them to do after they do what you need to have help with on your recalibration? Or is that just, maybe that's just wasn't well thought out?
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I want to emphasize Section 2. It says, commencing June 15th, the department shall provide monthly progress reports. And I think this is kind of an important part about what this task force will do, because the way I perceive recalibration, I've been through it twice, this is a lengthy, difficult process, and I expect that probably the recalibration committee in the interim will probably meet on a monthly basis, and so we put that provision in there to start, you know, giving us monthly progress reports on how it's going. As to the money, you know, I really can't answer that question. Why it goes to June 30, 2016, I would guess that's the end of the fiscal year, and any monies that are left will revert back at that point in time. Not really sure we know exactly how much we're going to spend, so we have this kind of a blanket number in there, knowing that whatever we don't spend will, in fact, revert back.
Any further discussion on House Bill 11? Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still trying to figure out exactly what they're going to tell us during recalibration. And I've read the 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 about what they're saying there. And as we look to it, I guess the other question would be, when we did recalibration a while ago, distance learning was not part of it, so we didn't need to have it then, and now it's become a big part of it. We've been talking about distance education for a long time. So I'm still confused as to what they're going to provide you that we didn't have when we did the last recalibration and what difference it's going to make.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, you know, distance education, the perspective of it has changed significantly since 2010. I mean, things are happening on a different basis, and there's much more, as a matter of fact, there's significant involvement with the small schools. More than there was back then. And there is a component in the K-12 prototypical model that does, in fact, address distance education. This is one of the areas that when we did the desk audit, that it became apparent that we needed to look at it again because things have changed significantly since 2010. I hope that answers your question.
Any further discussion? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 11, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 11 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our division being called. All those in favor, please rise.
Recalibration.
Opposed, no. House Bill 11 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our... Senator Perkins, privilege granted.
I just wanted to thank you for the humiliation. Thank you.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 146. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 146, Uniform Trust Code. Sponsored by Representative Brown. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Kinsey, Von Fladeren, Senator Hicks excused, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 146, Uniform Trust Code. There are no standing committee amendments. To further discuss the bill, I would ask that you call on President Nicholas.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, this is a really good bill. This is what happens when you sit and your colleague comes over and throws a bill in front of you. You put your signature on it. Mr. Chairman, there are, with respect to this bill, it goes in and it's taking a look at the Uniform Trust Code. As these folks began to draw these more and more complicated trusts, there was a 2013 amendment to the IRS code that provides that provides additional creditor protection for the transfer of property to trust which does not violate the Wyoming Uniform Fraudulent Trust Transfers Act. So the issue here is, when can you create a discretionary trust that allows for protection from creditors? And historically, you could do that, but you would have to set it up with a third-party corporate trustee. So now we're saying, well, you can actually set it up with a trustee that's not a corporate trustee, but is somebody that is a third party, that not a corporate trustee. But to do that, you have to meet certain requirements, including the transfer has to be more than 90 days for the bankruptcy look-back period to protect that. There's protection for creditors. There is a standard of proof under the Fraudulent Transfer Act, so you can't just go out and create these things and then go bankrupt the next 90 days. But it does provide more opportunities for folks to create these trusts. It does give the trustees some more powers, so that right now there are certain things that the beneficiary has to do, and what this does is assign to the trustee, which are the folks that are doing the trustee work, some more power, including the trustee may make elections for the on behalf of the trust. The trustee can decide on an annual basis whether capital gain income should be taxed or trusted or treated as distributed to the tax for the beneficiaries, so that in this instance, and then the third area is a new trust for a beneficiary. The trustee has the power under the original trust making the discretionary distributions to the beneficiary. So these are things that where, again, as more and more of these trusts get set up, people defer more and more decisions to the trustee. And this allows the trustee to make the IRS designations and requirements so that you don't find yourselves taxed inadvertently. With that, I'd urge you to support the bill.
Any further discussion? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, a brief discussion maybe on what the language is on the top of page 2, discretionary trust effective standard. It says, terms of a trust providing a trustee may make discretionary distribution to a beneficiary. And these are the words that got me thinking a little bit between the commas. Whether or not the discretionary distributions are pursuant to a standard of distribution. I just got to thinking in a trust that we had in our family where we had three beneficiaries. And this sounds like the trustee, if one of us could have talked the trustee into it, the standard of distribution in that trust basically is one-third, one-third, we could have just taken it all. And I'm just wondering how that actually works, because you got to have a standard of distribution. I'm just wondering why we're saying there's no standard of distribution.
Further discussion on House Bill 146. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll do my best to answer that question. What you're talking about at the top of page 2 is, in a discretionary trust, typically that's one of the ways that you make sure that trusts are oftentimes not subject to creditors and things like that. So you set up a trust for your kid and protect it from your kid's creditors. One of the ways you do that is having discretionary distributions. Because if they're discretionary with the trustee, when the trustee looks at all those circumstances, the trustee decides whether it's appropriate to make that distribution or not and how much that distribution should be. And thereby, by having the beneficiary not having an absolute right to a distribution, then a creditor can't attach that distribution. It can't grab onto that distribution before it comes out of the trust because it's discretion with the trustee. There's no property interest. There's no right because the trustee can distribute all. He can distribute the entire distribution or a part of the distribution or none of the distribution. So that's what we're talking about in discretionary trust, where other trusts might say you have to distribute so much of the, may have to distribute all the income. That wouldn't be what we're talking about here. Or it may be that you distribute 5% of the value of the trust as of the close of the last calendar year. That's not a discretionary distribution, so that wouldn't apply to these. But what we're talking about here is these discretionary distributions. Now, oftentimes what you have in there in a standard of distribution is there may not be a specific amount. It may not be income, or it may not be a percentage, or it may not be a specific amount. But sometimes the discretionary distribution simply says that it is that you distribute enough income or maybe principal to provide for the health, education, maintenance, and support of the beneficiary. That is called in the parlance and in with the IRS is a magical number called an ascertainable standard. And so what you're talking about here, I think, usually is going to be a reference to something like that, whether it's for the health and maintenance or for the comfort into which the person was accustomed to being kept, and those types of things. That's the standard of distributions. What we're saying here is that if there's a discretionary distribution, and discretion maybe also be based upon this ascertainable standard for the health, maintenance, and support of the beneficiary, that still doesn't create a property interest in the trust for that beneficiary. The significance of that, Mr. Chairman, is the creditors, by not creating that property interest, there's nothing to attach for a creditor to come down and drop a writ of attachment or a garnishment or something like that onto that distribution before it comes out to the beneficiary. Trust law for years and years, and this is just clarifying that, has been that trustees can't attach an interest that's still in that trust. They have to wait until it's actually distributed before it can be attached. And so this is just making it clear, Mr. Chairman, that on these other types of a standard of distribution, that even though that's in there, that it doesn't create a property interest in the trust that creditors can get a hold of and thereby defeat usually what is the person that made the trust maker's intent to protect that, usually for a child, a spouse, or a grandchild. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion on House Bill 146? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 146, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 146 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 214. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 214, Practice of Law Amendment, sponsored by Representative Brown. It was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Flatern, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 214, Practice of Law Amendments. There are no standing committee amendments to further discuss the bill. I would ask you to call on our highly esteemed President, Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, these are...
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, these are cleanup requirements asked by the State Bar. They've just gone through and asked for a variety of cleanup items to the statute. That's all they've done is just is for one of the early, examinations as the Bar Association. Really, it's pretty self-explanatory. Urge your support.
Any further discussion? Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little more discussion, though. I understand what they've done. You know, we took out the citizen of the United States, and I think I probably understand that, but I'd like to know why. And then Then what it goes to is it'll be accredited by the American Bar Association. Does this mean that we can have someone from a different country that may have practiced law over there, but it's accredited by the American Bar Association that could practice law in our state? That would be, those are some of the first questions that I would have. And then what it seems like we're doing here, too, is we're giving a lot of latitude by rules of the Supreme Court. And is that, do they not have rules now that allow them to do this, or are we changing allow them rules to do it, in fact, because it makes it more flexible to them to be able to do it and go through the rulemaking process?
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it's the latter. So with respect to all of these things, we're delegating it to the Wyoming Supreme Court to do more of the, or to do the things that are typically within their purview. So the Supreme Court has rules with respect to who can be authorized to practice law, how you get admission to the courts, how do you, mandatory continuing legal education. All these are things that are really in the purview of the Wyoming Supreme Court. They've already got rules governing the practice of law. They have bylaws of the state bar. So in Wyoming, it's an integrated bar. So to be admitted to practice in front of the any court in Wyoming, you have to be admitted to not only the Wyoming state bar, but you have to be admitted to practice before the Supreme Court. And what this essentially does is clean up these statutes and push back these regulatory items back to the Wyoming Supreme Court, and they already have these regulations governing these eligibility requirements.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, it appears to me that this is a good deal more than just cleanup, so I have several questions. The first, I always look at a licensure law to see where the fence is. And so I have a question with regard to the provision on page 2 and page 3. As I read it now, you can't be admitted to the bar of this state who's not an adult, of good moral character, who's been awarded Juris Doctor degree from a law school accredited. What you're repealing is two things. It seems to me that you're not allowing any degree lesser than Juris Doctor. And I understand that degree inflation has occurred in the legal profession as well as many others. But what about the lawyers who graduated earlier who have a degree that's lesser than Juris Doctor? Are they being now fenced out of being admitted to the practice newly, or am I missing something there? And, Mr. Chairman, for years there was a way you could become a lawyer by reading law in the office of another attorney, and it seems to me that I think it was true that my first judiciary chairman over in the House had become a lawyer that way. It was still allowed relatively recently in the state, and they're getting rid of that. Is that practice gone totally by the boards? That was, you know, a lot of famous people, I think, including the 16th President of the United States, became a lawyer that way. So, Mr. Chairman, I have a set of questions about that, then I've got a set of questions about the repealers.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The senator from Casper is correct. There was a process for many years that would allow an attorney to take 1 year of law school, and then you could go out and practice with an attorney for 3 or 4 years. In fact, my grandfather was a lawyer in Casper. That's the way he became an attorney. He went to 1 year, one of the first years of the law school established at Laramie. After a year, he went out and practiced with attorneys. And over a course of, I think, 5 years of practice, was admitted to the bar. That practice has been abandoned or precluded for at least since my career. So that in the early, sometime in the 80s, I would guess, or earlier than that, the practice was disregarded for a number of reasons. One is no one was doing that. Two, there was really no mechanism to provide the training, and there's really no program out there. It's just different becoming a lawyer than it used to be, if you will. And I think part of it is just a lack of a cohesive program. But in this instance, the statutory changes actually don't change anything that is currently the law. That process of being able to go to law school 1 year or 2 years and then practice with an attorney for a number of years has been gone as long as my career has been around since the 80s.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, what about the question of degrees? Because this clearly says, as I read it, you've got to have a Juris Doctor degree. When did that change take place? And are there still attorneys who may wish to come to Wyoming that because they're older, don't have that degree, have a different degree?
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's about the same time. As long as I've been practicing, you've always had to have a JD. It isn't that hard. Just go to law school. You have had to have a law degree to sit for the bar exam and to as long as I can recall. So that process, again, where you could even sit for the bar and take the exam without having gone to a law school, it's been that way, again, as long as my career goes, which has spanned a lot of years. So you do now have to have a three-year law degree to sit for the bar, and that's been the case. And that's through rules of the Supreme Court, which have now been in existence for a long time.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I fear my question's not being understood. There was a period of time where they didn't call the three-year degree a Juris Doctor degree. Are all those lawyers that got the lesser took the 3 years of law school, but they called the degree something else at that point. Are those all dead and gone, or are there still some of those around who might want to come to practice and would be fenced out by this?
Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, it goes well back before my career, since there was a degree other than a Juris Doctorate. I do recall years past school. In fact, I think Harvard was one where you could actually get an LLB degree. But those degrees, I'm not aware of any school that offers it now, and I'm not aware. I think they're all JDs. So, and frankly, I don't know anybody that has an LLB anymore. So that's best I can answer that.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not surprised they all give the JD degree now. What I'm really asking is, are we fencing out somebody who got the LLB degree earlier, is still around, may move to Wyoming, and simply has a piece of paper that has a different label to it?
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to that, is that if you if you want to get into practice in Wyoming through reciprocity, so that some other state has allowed you to get there, there are a separate set of reciprocity rules that the Supreme Court has. And if you've practiced in another state for more than 5 years, and you've done certain requirements and had a career, if you will, as an attorney successfully, you can get reciprocity. But it is true that if you had today, if you came out yesterday with an LLB, you've never practiced law anybody, you could not sit for the exam. But there would be nobody that this would apply to that's already admitted. For example, if you are, if my grandfather was still alive, he could still practice today, even with his old degree, because we're not going to take it away from him.
Any further discussion? Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Page 4, lines 15 through 17, then there's a bunch deleted, and then the next page, lines 2 through 4, say person is admitted to practice an attorney in the highest court of any other state and territory may be admitted to the bar of this state pursuant to the rules of the Supreme Court. So kind of states it right in the bill.
Any further discussion? Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, the repealer on page 7 of the bill, repealing 335114 and 335115, let me just read 335114. It's very brief. An attorney or counselor is guilty of deceit or collusion or consents thereto with the intent to deceive a court or judge or a party to an action or proceeding or bring suit or commences proceedings without authority, therefore, is liable to be disbarred and shall forfeit to the injured party treble damages to be recovered in a civil action. Mr. Chairman, I'd like some discussion on why that's being removed. That doesn't look like just cleanup. Is it somewhere else? Have the bar decided that treble damages is a penalty that's not appropriate? This looks like quite a substantive change. 33.515, attorney may be required to show authority. Court may, on motion of either party and showing reasonable grounds, require the attorney for the adverse party or for any one of several adverse parties to produce or prove by his own oath or otherwise the authority under which he appears, and until he does so, may stay all proceedings by him on behalf of the parties for whom he assumes to appear. Is that one might, I would think, might well be covered elsewhere in the court rules. But I would want to know some discussion on both of those.
Senator Nicholas.
Both of those, they're both antiquated languages that's never been utilized by the court to our knowledge. There's never been a reported case for the Wyoming Supreme Court. But in general, what's happening now is that the court does regulate through the Wyoming Code of Professional Conduct, which is we have a judicial code of conduct and attorney code of conduct that applies to all attorneys, and the code of ethics, if you will, that's enforced by the Supreme Court and has its own sanctions separately to this, including disbarment and other procedures and compensation to victims, is now controlling over that. So what's happened over time is that nobody's ever used these antiquated provisions. They're not quite consistent with the rules of professional conduct. Rules of professional conduct now govern fully all of the issues with respect to lawyer conduct, misconduct, and the Supreme Court is asking then that we clarify this up, and really you're directing it back to the Supreme Court to be the enforcer of the code of ethics for attorneys, so that there is remedies, and each one of these has a separate or two or three provisions, if you will, in the Wyoming Code of Professional Conduct.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the cases that are cited on this, and in both cases it sounds like the party that was trying to claim the damages failed, but one of them is August of 2000, one of them is August 2009. It would seem that they have been at least attempted to be used recently. And does the on 314, is the Supreme Court imposing treble damages, or is that what they're trying to get rid of?
Further discussion on the bill. No, seeing no further discussion, question, Senator Nicholas.
I'll answer those questions. My computer's gone dead, so it hasn't been plugged in all day. I'll find out the questions and respond to those. But what I believe is the notes that I have from my colleague is that they have not been successfully utilized in any reported decision of the Supreme Court. So I'll go back and look at those cases and report to my colleague on that. But the certainly the attorney is always subject to civil liability and will be resulted in disciplinary action. But the civil liability, you're right, would not command the treble damage provision that you're speaking of. So to that extent, the treble damages provision would be deleted, and the report that I've got from my colleague is that there's no evidence that the treble damages language has ever been applied.
Further discussion. Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 214, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 214 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
You left a mess back here.
If the reading clerk will please read the journal committee, or not the journal committee. Every time I see him, if the reading clerk will please read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. President, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 25, do pass amended. House Bill 61, do pass. House Bill 149, do pass. House Bill 138 do pass. House Bill 139 do pass. House Bill 107 do pass. House Bill 197 do pass. House Joint Resolution 6 do pass. House Bill 180 do pass. House Bill 150 do pass. House Bill 126 do pass. House Bill 11 do pass amended. House Bill 146 do pass. And House Bill 214 do pass. Senator Wasserberger, Chairman.
Chairman Wasserberger.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted. We have standing committee reports.
February the 23rd, 2015, Mr. President, Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 174, engrossed, Nicotine Products Regulation, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
The Conference Committee to House Bill Number 1, the Joint Conference Committee for House Bill Number 1, Senate File Number 1, are Ross, Chairman, Burns, Perkins, Wasserberger, and Hastert. Then we have other Conference Committee report. That's great. Thank you. The Conference Committee report for House Bill Number 17, which responds in part to message number 339, is Hastert, Chairman, Perkins, and Ross. The Conference Committee for House Bill 154, which responds to part to message number 343, is Meyer, Chairman, Von Fladen, and Hicks. the Conference Committee report for House Bill number 42, Unclaimed Property and Merchant Stored Value Cards, responding in part to message number 341. Is Case Chairman, Pappas, and Scott. We have signing of enrolled acts. Senate Enrolled Act number 20.
Senate Enrolled Act number 20, being original Senate File 36, an act relating to crimes and offenses and consumer protection.
I'm about ready to sign Senate Enrolled Act number 20, being original Senate File number 36. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 21.
Senate Enrolled Act number 21, being original Senate File 102, an act relating to Medicaid.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act number 21 that was original Senate File number 102. So signed. Senate Enrolled Act number 22.
Senate Enrolled Act number 22, being original Senate File 35, an act relating to consumer protection.
I'm about ready to sign Senate Enrolled Act number 22, being original Senate File number 35. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act number 23.
Senate Enrolled Act number 23, being original Senate File 117, an act relating to environmental quality.
I'm about ready to sign Senate Enrolled Act number 23, being original Senate File number 117. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 42.
House Enrolled Act number 42, being original House Bill 51, an act relating to taxation and revenue.
I'm about ready to sign House Enrolled Act number 42, being original House Bill number 51. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 43.
House Enrolled Act number 43, being original House Bill 27, an act relating to environmental quality.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 43, being original House Bill number 27. I've so signed. Messages from the House.
February the 23rd, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 343, concurrence failed. Mr. President, House Bill number 154, complementary hunting license persons with disability. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 10, 40, noes 49, excused 1. The House requests the Senate appoint Conference Committee number 1 to meet with the like committee from the House to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. February 23rd, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 341, concurrence failed. Mr. President, House Bill number 42, unclaimed property, merchant stored value cards. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 21, noes 38, excused 1. House requests the Senate appoint a conference committee number 1 to meet with a like committee from the House to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 23rd, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 6. Mr. President, the House has completed consideration of the budget bill, Senate File 1, pursuant to Joint Resolution 14-1. Senate File 1 is referred directly to a conference committee of 5 members from each House to meet and report recommended amendments for final consideration by both houses with respect to budget bills, Senate File 1, House Bill 1, and the amendments thereto. House of Representatives, February 23, 2015, message 346, conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the House appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to Senate File 1. The House conferees are Representative Harshman, Chairman, Representatives Gere, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 23rd, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message 347, conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1, Mr. President. The House appointed House conferees to meet with the like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to House Bill 17. The House conferees are Representative Miller, Chairman, Representative Connolly and Gear. From the House of Representatives, February 23, 2015, message number 348. Conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1, Mr. President. The House appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to House Bill 42. The House conferees are Representative Dan Zwanitzer, Chairman, Representative Larson and Lindholm, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. You want any of these back?
Senator Bebout?
Mr. President, I think you appointed a conference committee before one of those reports have been read in. You might want to do it after it is.
What we're told is it got read in twice, Senator Bivada. You're right. We were just having this discussion. Let me confirm right now. Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. I think that the explanation is that it got read in twice. But notwithstanding that, just to make sure that we're okay, the Conference Committee for House Bill 42, Unclaimed Property, Merchant Stored Value Cards, is Senator Case, Chairman Pappas, and Scott. And I had the same question, but it's cleared up now. So do we have a conference? Pardon? Oh, that's fine. Senator Ross, are you ready on message number 327 on Senate Joint Resolution 2? You have the floor. Let's get it read in first.
February 20th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 327, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate Joint Resolution 2, Investment of State Funds. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 48, noes 11, excused 1. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendment. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Scott. Excuse me.
I got taller.
Yeah, you did. You just lost a lot of weight, too.
Stand on my chair,
please. Senator Ross.
I need a mic, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move message number 327, concurrence request on Senate Joint Resolution 2, investment of state funds, and urge the Senate to vote no. Mr. President, the language that they added in that I believe is problematic is on page 3, and the top of the, it would be, begins on the bottom of page 2 and then goes over to page 3. What they did is they struck the sentence, the legislature may prescribe different investment conditions for each fund. And then if you look at the language now, the language still stays in about two-thirds majority to increase percentage of any fund that may be invested in this subparagraph. But then they added a sentence after that said, a majority of both houses of the legislature voting separately may prescribe different investment conditions for each fund. That seems to be inconsistent. I would urge you to vote no.
Discussions, Mr. Majority Floor Leader Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. I, too, would urge the body to vote no. It is wrong, and it's confusing as well, and then they get back up to the top of it where they take the word out legislature and put majority of both houses. We need to go over and talk to them and see what they're up to. We spent a lot of time working on this language, Mr. President. Thought we had it in pretty good shape, and what they have now, it'll just not work.
The question is on Senate Joint Resolution Number 2, Investment of State Funds, message number 325. The motion is to concur, and you've been asked to vote no. Roll call.
Anderson, District 2?
No.
Anderson, District 28?
No.
Barnard?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
Kraft?
Excused.
Dockstetter?
Excused.
Driscoll?
Excused.
Emmerich? Escobel? Geis?
Excused.
Hastert?
No.
Hicks?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Kinski?
No.
Landon?
Excused.
Meyer?
Excused. Oh, he's there. He's excused, too.
Meyer, no. Pappas?
No.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
Excused.
Ross?
No.
Rothfuss?
Excused.
Scott?
No.
Von Fladern?
No.
Wasserberger?
No.
President Nicholas?
No.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 23 no, 7 excused.
By your vote, you voted not to concur on Senate Joint Resolution Number 2, Investment of State Funds. By explanation, folks, the House is out in their committee's meeting, so folks have asked for permission to go attend some committees and present their bills. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that does clear the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that the Senate be adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Announcements. Senator Kinski.
Mr. President, it is my pleasure on behalf of Revenue Committee Chairman Peterson to announce that Revenue Committee Number 3 will meet Tuesday, tomorrow.
Pull up your mic, please. There you go.
On behalf of Revenue Committee Peterson, it's my pleasure to announce that Revenue Number 3 will meet tomorrow, Tuesday, February 24th, Room S16, 30 minutes afternoon recess to consider House Bill 81, Wyoming Lottery Distributions, and House Bill 26, Engrossed Property Tax Exemption for Religious Education Camps.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet in about 10 minutes up in room S14 to discuss House Bill 85, Motor Vehicle Passing Bicycles, House Bill 193, Engrossed Veteran Burial Teams, House Bill 143, Engrossed Motor Vehicle Registration Fees.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Appropriations Committee number 2 will meet at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning in S11 to consider the following re-referrals: House Bill 144, Education, School Safety and Security, and House Bill 152, Industrial Siting Impact Payments. And members of the Senate, your Joint Conference Committee on the Budget will begin its deliberations at 12:30 tomorrow on the budget.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Travel Committee number 6 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room S14 to consider House Bill 208, Engrossed Hard-to-Draw Hunting Licenses.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Committee number 12, Rules, will meet in about 5 minutes in room S11 to discuss the following House bills: House Bill 75, Balanced Budget Compact; House Joint Resolution 4, Balanced Budget Amendment Resolution; House Joint Resolution 1, Engrossed Regulation Freedom; and House Bill 121, Engrossed Article 5, Convention Limitations.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion is adopted. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, February 24th.